I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
In a major policy shift, President Trump orders the end of U.S. sanctions on Syria and meets with Syria's new president. The meeting in Saudi Arabia came a day after the U.S. and Saudi Arabia signed a new $142 billion arms deal. As Trump lands in Qatar on his next stop, we'll look at Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates.
President Trump's trip to the Middle East is really about one thing, money. Whether it's about securing weapons deals and trade deals for the United States, whether it's securing a $400 million plane for his personal use, whether it's about making clear that the Gulf states can depend on the United States so long as they're buying from the United States.
We'll speak to Sarah Lee Whitson of Dawn and Akbar Shahid Ahmed of HuffPost. Then, to a Salvadoran journalist who had to flee El Salvador, along with others from the news outlet El Faro, after Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele threatened to arrest them for exposing how Bukele made secret deals with Salvadoran gangs. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel is intensifying its assault on Gaza as President Trump visits the Gulf region. At least 70 Palestinians, including many children, were killed earlier today when Israel struck five residential buildings in Jabalia City and its refugee camp. On Tuesday, Israeli warplanes dropped nine bunker buster bombs on the European hospital complex, killing at least 28 Palestinians and wounding dozens of others. Israeli officials claim the target of the attack was Mohammed Sinwar, a top Hamas leader. Hamas has denied claims it operates out of hospitals. Meanwhile, mourners gathered Tuesday in Khan Yunis for the funeral of the prominent Palestinian journalist Hassan Asliya, who was killed in a targeted strike earlier in the day while he was being treated at Nasser Hospital for wounds from a previous Israeli airstrike. He was the 215th media worker killed by Israel. This is the Palestinian photojournalist Samir Abouchi.
This is a violation of the sanctity of journalism and of our rights. The vest and helmet we wear no longer protect us, unfortunately.
Doctors in Gaza are condemning Israel for targeting two medical facilities Tuesday. Dr. Ataf Al-Hut is the director of Nasser Hospital.
I came to the hospital not knowing whether to mourn the martyrs, treat the patients and injured, or the staff who no longer feel safe. How can I protect in my capacity as the director of this place? We are speaking to a blind world that sees an amputated child, sees the limbs of children, and does nothing. I speak of women who were killed and exterminated. We speak of elderly people. What more is required of us now?
At the United Nations, the UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Tom Fletcher called on world leaders to, quote, prevent genocide, unquote, in Gaza. He slammed Israel's 10-week blockade, which has resulted in more than 500,000 Palestinians facing starvation in Gaza.
We have life-saving supplies ready now at the borders. We can save hundreds of thousands of survivors. We have rigorous mechanisms to ensure our aid gets to civilians and not to Hamas. But Israel denies us access, placing the objective of depopulating Gaza before the lives of civilians.
Fletcher also denounced a U.S.-backed Israeli plan to have private security contractors run aid operations in Gaza. Meanwhile, in London, the British High Court began hearing a case Tuesday accusing the British government of violating international humanitarian law by exporting F-35 fighter jet components to Israel. The case was brought by the legal groups Al-Haq and Global Legal Action Network. President Trump has arrived in Qatar after 2 days in Saudi Arabia. Earlier today, Trump met with Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, the former al-Qaeda leader who helped topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad last December. During the meeting in Saudi Arabia, Trump urged al-Sharaa to normalize ties with Israel and join the Abraham Accords. Trump also asked the Syrian leader to deport Palestinians he described as, quote, terrorists. After the meeting, Trump said, quote, we're currently exploring normalizing relations with Syria's new government, unquote. The meeting took place hours after Trump pledged to lift U.S. sanctions on Syria in a major policy shift.
I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
Much of Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia focused on securing new investments for U.S. companies. On Tuesday, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia signed a new $142 billion arms deal in what the White House called, quote, the largest defense cooperation agreement in U.S. history. After visiting Qatar, Trump will head to the United Arab Emirates. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he'll travel to Turkey this week to seek a ceasefire deal with Russia. The Kremlin, meanwhile, says a Russian delegation will be in Istanbul for possible direct peace talks, though it's not clear whether President Vladimir Putin will personally attend, nor is it clear whether President Donald Trump will join the negotiations. Ahead of his trip to Turkey, Zelensky said he'll only believe Russia is serious about ending its invasion of Ukraine if Putin joins the face-to-face talks.
If they will not come, if Putin will not come, or if ceasefire will not be supported by Russians, by Putin exactly, by him. So it's been only one thing, that Russia is not ready for any kind of negotiation.
Meanwhile, Russia's continuing its deadly attacks on Ukraine. Kyiv says Russia used 100 drones in an overnight assault Monday, while on Tuesday, Russian bombs killed three civilians in Ukraine's Kharkiv region. On Capitol Hill, police arrested more than two dozen people Tuesday as they protested Republican plans to gut Medicaid and other programs for the poor and working class to help cover the cost of $4.5 trillion in tax breaks for the rich. An emerging Republican budget proposal intends to cut social spending by $880 billion, largely by slashing Medicaid, which the Congressional Budget Office estimates would leave 8.6 million people without health care over the next decade. Protesters lined the halls outside a meeting of the House Energy and Commerce Committee Tuesday, while inside, a demonstrator was led away by police after disrupting the hearing.
You will kill me!
House Republicans are seeking to grant the Trump administration the sweeping authority to target nonprofits that don't align with President Trump's agenda. A measure included in the House Ways and Means Committee's draft reconciliation bill would grant the Treasury Secretary the power to declare any nonprofit as a terrorist-supporting organization in order to strip it of its tax-exempt status. In a statement, the nonprofit Fight for the Future called the measure a five-alarm fire for nonprofits nationwide, adding, quote, this terribly thought-out legislation means that under the current administration, every environmental, racial justice, LGBTQ+, gender justice, immigration justice, and particularly any anti-genocide organization throughout the country may be on the chopping block, unquote. A federal judge in Pennsylvania has upheld President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport Venezuelan immigrants without due process. U.S. District Judge Stephanie Lou Haynes' ruling is the first to support Trump's use of the 1798 wartime law, after judges in three other federal jurisdictions ruled Trump does not have the power to use the Alien Enemies Act to deport alleged gang members. Judge Haynes was nominated to the federal bench by Trump during his first term. On Monday, disgraced former Congressmember Matt Gaetz of Florida brought a television crew from the far-right One America News Network into the CECOT mega prison in El Salvador. Footage shows prisoners, some of whom were deported from the U.S. without due process, packed into crowded cells shouting freedom and using hand gestures calling for help. We'll have more on El Salvador, CECOT, and the Salvadoran president later in the broadcast. 20 U.S. states have sued the Trump administration after it threatened to withhold billions of dollars in federal funds unless states cooperate with Trump's mass deportation efforts. In a pair of lawsuits, the states argue Trump has exceeded his constitutional authority by dictating how federal funds should be spent when only Congress has that power. A federal jury in Wisconsin's indicted Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Hannah Dugan on charges of obstructing justice and concealing an individual from arrest. Federal prosecutors, including Attorney General Pam Bondi, have accused Judge Dugan of helping an undocumented immigrant leave her courtroom on April 18th to avoid arrest by agents waiting in the hallway. This month, more than 150 former state and federal judges signed an open letter condemning the arrest. They write, quote, "This attempt to intimidate the judiciary will fail. The American people understand that the Constitution of the United States has made the nation's judicial officers the guardians of the rule of law in our country, not the president," unquote. In New Jersey, Newark Mayor Ross Baraka returned to an immigration detention center Tuesday for the first time since his arrest by masked federal agents last Friday. Baraka is due in federal court on Thursday to face trespassing charges, where he's set to plead not guilty. He was arrested on Newark public property after he tried unsuccessfully to tour the 1,000-bed for-profit ICE jail with three Democratic Congress members, Bonnie Watson-Coleman, LaMonica McIver, and Rob Menendez. On Tuesday, Georgia Republican Congressmember Buddy Carter introduced a House resolution to strip the three Congress members of their committee assignments. This comes after the Department of Homeland Security threatened to arrest the lawmakers. On Tuesday, House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries dismissed the idea that Trump would seek to prosecute members of Congress.
No one's intimidated by this dude. No one. And so there are clear lines that they just dare not cross.
To see our interview with Mayor Ross Baraka, go to democracynow.org. A federal judge has stripped New York City of control over its jails, citing years of violence and neglect at the notorious Rikers Island Correctional Facility. Federal Judge Laura Taylor Swain said in Tuesday's ruling she would appoint a remediation manager to address widespread abuses, including physical and sexual violence, severe psychological harm to prisoners, and medical neglect. At least 38 people have died at Rikers Island since Mayor Eric Adams took office in 2022. And Jose Mujica, the former president of Uruguay, has died at the age of 89. He was elected in 2010 and was often described as the world's poorest president for his adoption of a simple lifestyle and his critiques of capitalism. During the 70s and 80s, he was jailed and tortured for 14 years for his activity as a guerrilla fighting Uruguay's military dictatorship. This is Jose Mujica speaking in 2014.
Humanity has to consider some issues that are global, and the central powerful countries are those that have the greater responsibility.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, in a major policy shift President Trump orders the end of U.S. sanctions on Syria and meets with Syria's new president in Saudi Arabia. The meeting came a day after the U.S. and Saudi Arabia signed a new $142 billion arms deal. As Trump lands in Qatar on his next stop, we'll look at Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Stay with us.
It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight, I want heaven. Hey, with you. It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight, I want heaven. Hey, with you.
It was 11:59 and 59 clicks. The whole world's burning, but the clock just ticks over and over every single day. Some people steal while other people pray to God, to man, machines, or whatever. Some of us just lost faith altogether. No way, they say, we can't live this way. That's why so many people stand up and say, one love, one blood, one heart, one soul, and one drum, and only one rhythm. One tribe and all of us singing. It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight, I want heaven. Hey, with you. It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight.
11:59 by Michael Franti, here in our Democracy Now! Studio over a decade ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump has arrived in Qatar after 2 days in Saudi Arabia. Earlier today, President Trump met in Riyadh with Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, the former al-Qaeda leader who helped topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad last December. During the meeting, Trump urged al-Sharaa to normalize ties with Israel and join the Abraham Accords. Trump also asked the Syrian leader to deport Palestinians he described as, quote, terrorists. After the meeting, Trump said, quote, we're currently exploring normalizing relations with Syria's new government, unquote. The meeting took place hours after Trump pledged to lift U.S. sanctions on Syria in a major policy shift.
In Syria, which has seen so much misery and death, there is a new government that will hopefully succeed in stabilizing the country and keeping peace. That's why my administration has already taken the first steps toward restoring normal relations between the United States and Syria for the first time in more than a decade. I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
Much of President Trump's trip to the Gulf has focused on securing new deals for U.S. companies. On Tuesday, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia signed a new $142 billion arms deal and what the White House has called the largest defense cooperation agreement Washington has ever achieved. Trump claims Saudi Arabia has pledged to invest $1 trillion in the United States.
And with this trip, we're adding over $1 trillion more in terms of investment and investment into our country and buying our products. And, you know, nobody makes military equipment like us. We have the best military equipment, the best missiles, the best rockets, the best everything. Best submarines, by the way.
President Trump is now in Qatar and then will head to the United Arab Emirates. He's facing increasing bipartisan criticism over reports that Qatar's preparing to give him a $400 million luxury plane known as the Flying Palace. We're joined now by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Akbar Shahid Ahmed, the senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, is with us. His latest piece is headlined A Moment of Truth in the Middle East for Donald Trump. And Steve Witkoff. His former forthcoming book on the Biden administration in Gaza is titled Crossing the Red Line. And here in New York, Sarah Lee Whitson is with us, the executive director of DAWN, an organization working to reform U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Sarah Lee Whitson, let's begin with you. Your assessment of what's happened over the last 2 days, both his visits with these three countries, he's about to go to the United Arab Emirates, just landed in Qatar, in Doha, but also what this means for Israel.
Well, this is a very volatile moment in the Middle East, and we've seen some pivots that we really haven't seen for decades in terms of independent U.S. decision-making in the Middle East. President Trump has ended sanctions on Syria. He's reached a truce in Yemen with the Houthis. He's declared that he's going to have diplomatic negotiations with Iran, all without the consent or veto of Israel, which previously existed. Meanwhile, he's dramatically expanding America's economic ties to the Gulf states, declaring that if you can pay, then you can play. The massive announcement of trade deals with Saudi Arabia, $600 billion, the largest weapons deal, $148 billion with Saudi Arabia, and really no talk at all of a normalization with Israel as any kind of a condition, including for the development of a civilian nuclear plant. What we still don't know is what Saudi's going to charge the United States in return, whether there's going to be a defense pact, which is, of course, what Saudi Arabia has long been looking for.
And, Sarah, what about all of the CEOs of major U.S. corporations that have also headed to the Middle East as well for during these days? What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, the days of Saudi isolation in the wake of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, when some of these very same business leaders absented themselves from appearing in Saudi Arabia, are long over. And now I think American companies are looking to cash in on the billions of dollars of the Saudi Public Investment Fund, the Emirati Public Investment Fund, the Qatari Public Investment Fund. This is a boondoggle for American businesses because the Gulf states understand that in order to continue to secure U.S. protection, they must expand their investments in U.S. businesses.
And in terms of the ceasefire in Yemen that that Trump has implemented, as well as other actions he's taken that seem to be marginalizing Israel and the Netanyahu administration. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, the ceasefire with the Yemen and the Houthis is an excellent development. And I wish that every other American president had ended failed catastrophic wars after a mere 2 months, which is the deadline that President Trump imposed on this foolish incursion into Yemen, which has put us back exactly where we were before the incursion started. This was never a conflict that the United States was pursuing in U.S. interests, but clearly to support Israel and to protect Israel. I think it's a very important signal that President Trump is now making decisions that more closely align with U.S. interests than with Israel's interests. I think it's very notable that the Houthis launched an attack on Israel a mere day after this ceasefire was announced, making clear, underlining really, that the ceasefire does not include sustaining or suspending attacks on Israel.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed, you've written an extensive piece about the meaning of this trip. And again, at this point of this broadcast, President Trump's landed in Doha, but he just met with the Syrian president and said they're dropping all sanctions against Syria, which also includes, presumably, against he himself, against the Syrian president. If you can talk about the significance of this moment and what you thought was most significant in the meetings and Saudi Arabia with the crown prince and the investment, a massive meeting of hundreds of CEOs. You see Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sitting right next to Elon Musk.
Right, Amy. But with the meeting with President Shara, which is the first meeting between an American president and a Syrian president in more than two decades, that's a real signal that Trump, as Sarah Lee said, is pursuing a policy that's a little different than what the Israelis certainly would like. This is the culmination of a months-long battle within Trump's own administration that I've been reporting on, where there are still many neoconservatives, kind of pro-Israel hardliners, the folks who've been in the Republican ecosystem for many, many years, who were not supportive of this kind of policy on Syria. So for President Trump to be in Saudi Arabia, publicly embracing the Syrian president, not just saying hello, which is what the White House told us he was going to do yesterday, he actually had a more extensive conversation and has expressed a lot of hopes for U.S.-Syria engagement. I think that's quite striking, right? It's certainly showing you a U.S. approach that, as some regional sources have described to me, they see as more even-handed because they believe now, rather than under the Biden administration, certainly, but even administrations before that, there was a U.S. policy very much conceived not just in coordination with Israel, but often shaped by an assumption about how Israel would react, right? Which was kind of shaping how officials were having even internal conversations. I will hazard, though, I think what's really significant to remember is who's not being talked about. There was also some chatter that Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas might come to Saudi Arabia. That didn't happen, right? And so even while President Trump is in Saudi, is making these conversations about peace between the U.S. and Syria, Syria and Israel, Gaza is still being pummeled, and we're still seeing a blockade of more than 70 days there, where one in five Gazans is facing extreme starvation. There hasn't been food, there hasn't been fuel, there hasn't been medicine, and all of that is backed by the U.S. So President Trump is putting forward this image that, yes, I'm not necessarily aligning with Israel at all times. At the same time, he's making significant concessions and approvals to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to continue the war, continue pummeling Palestinians.
And Akbar, what do you make? There's been a lot of press attention to this donation of the royal family of Qatar of a $400 million luxury 747 plane to President Trump or to the United States. What's your take on this?
I think, Juan, it's going to be a really serious wrinkle in President Trump's attempt at diplomacy. A lot of what he's trying to do, whether it's weapons sales, whether it's a potential defense treaty with Saudi Arabia, does have to go through Congress. I think this is going to become a significant issue. Democrats are going to latch onto this, claiming corruption, and some Republicans are already uncomfortable with it. I think the concern about this is not just about an ethical appearance of taking a gift from the Qataris, which has its own concerns. It's also about policymaking and real strategic danger. When I've been talking to regional officials, Western officials, U.S. officials, they're saying, look, Trump's deal-making approach is part of why he kind of plays so well with these Arab states that are very transactional, don't want to hear moralistic rhetoric about human rights, or even long-term strategy. They want to just pay to play, as Sarah Lee put it. But does that lead to just short-term wins, right? Or does that lead to the personal and private mixing in ways where President Trump can walk away saying, I feel great, I got this plane, and maybe I've got some deals. What's the long-term strategic danger there? You know, and a lot of my reporting on Trump and his envoy to the region, Steve Witkoff, has focused on how they're pursuing really unconventional, really personalistic dealings with these leaders. In one instance, the leader of the United Arab Emirates, Steve Witkoff, who's Trump's envoy, had a 10-hour meeting with him where he didn't tell any other U.S. officials what was discussed. So that kind of policy-making process, I think, is the risk behind this extreme personalized and potentially corrupt relationship.
I mean, I wanted you to talk more about who Steve Witkoff is. I mean, this trip started before President Trump got on the plane to Saudi Arabia, right? It started with Adan Alexander, the Israeli-American hostage who Israel didn't negotiate to get him out. The U.S. negotiated directly, presumably with Witkoff, with Hamas to get him out. And he didn't meet with Netanyahu, and he's coming to the United States. The significance of this complete sidelining, icing out of Israel that began before Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely, Amy. Witkoff has been the man shaping the region, not just since January when Trump took office, but to a large extent in November and December, in those waning months of the Biden administration. Witkoff was the person who really negotiated that Gaza ceasefire that did last from January to March. Since then is when you've seen the beginning of the sidelining you talk about. Based on my sources, I've understood that Witkoff has actually personally told people he felt played by Netanyahu because it was Israel that broke the ceasefire, went back into Gaza, and really undercut what Witkoff and, by extension, President Trump were trying to do. So this kind of sense of we don't have to coordinate with the Israelis is very much linked to Witkoff's view that he is a personally empowered envoy of Trump. He's a personal friend of Trump's. And importantly, he's personally wealthy and he's not political, right? So compared to, say, U.S. officials in previous administrations or even in this one, he's not someone who's looking at how do I advance international security establishment for years to come? How does challenging Israel potentially put me at risk? And so that's something where talking to a lot of regional officials, U.S. officials, they feel he is able to be a little more even-handed and a little less driven by a fixation on Israel. But I think that also puts him in the crosshairs of a lot of the pro-Israel kind of advocacy ecosystem that does exist, right? And we've seen that come out already. There's been a lot of attacks on Witkoff personally, his business ties with Qatar, his potentially, you know, unconventional tactics. But Witkoff very much has the trust